Okay, we are taking up our second lecture tonight, talking about the background material to the book we are featuring throughout this series entitled The Great and Holy War. And our particular interest in this theme of World War I and the lectures we're doing to provide background to the book, the subtopic of the book here is how World War I became a religious crusade. So as Christians, we're particularly interested in current events and some of the things that we have to face in the modern world. And as Christians, we have a different perspective and a take on things than others do. So my focus here is to raise a number of these issues to see how World War I not only impacted the geopolitical affairs that we see on the evening news, but how great an impact that war had upon Christianity in general and American Christianity, particularly Protestant evangelical Christianity in particular. We're going to see tonight, especially after the war begins, the way in which American churches, both the progressive left and on the fundamentalist right, really struggle to make sense out of the issues raised by the start of World War I. So that's why I showed the film tonight, to give you some historical background to the start of the war. And then the lecture, we're going to deal with the question, first, what are those geopolitical forces driving the European nations toward unstable and confusing alliances that, as we saw in our film, led to World War I? And then the bulk of our time tonight, we're going to talk about a related question: how did American and European Christians react to the start of the war? And I think there's some important questions raised by how we, as professing Christians, should look at the start of World War I. Because, as Philip Jenkins points out, the great irony in this war is essentially Christian nations waging war upon one another in the name of Christ. And that thesis alone should shudder us to our gills, and that will be the heart of our discussion as we proceed. So what are then those geopolitical forces driving the European nations toward these unstable and confusing alliances, which you got a kind of hint of here at the film, and then eventually led to war in 1914? Well, the first one, I have them listed for you here, are factors that are connected to the rise of Germany as a modern nation within the context of a historic Europe. And this really begins, most historians would say, with Napoleon's invasion of Germany and Germany's later reaction to it. But, you know, we have to start a little bit more recent times than that. So I think the real hinge here is Prussia's overwhelming and very rapid victory over France in the Franco-Prussian War of 1871. Otto von Bismarck, who is the newly appointed chancellor of the Reich, what was left of the First Reich, instigates a war between France and Prussia, and Prussia wins a very quick, very thorough, very rapid victory over the French. And that starts, in a way, this simmering feud between two neighboring European powers, Germany and France, with France really resenting and feeling inferior to the Germans up until World War I and then again in World War II and then post-World War II. So a lot of the outcomes of the war are influenced by the French sense of defeat from this Prussian-Franco War of 1871. The real bite here is that Prussia occupies, after the war is over, the Alsace-Lorraine, which is that strip of land on the French side of the Rhine River. The main city is Strasbourg. It's an area rich in coal and other things. And once Germany wins that war in 1871, occupies the Alsace, the French are going to have continuing animosity toward the Germans, and there's going to be a long-standing desire in the French Foreign Office and in the French popular mind to regain the Alsace. That's one of these smoldering embers that will remain smoldering until the start of the war. After the unification of Germany in 1871, it's hard for us to realize, but Germany is a series of duchies and kingdoms and these odd little European nation states that are, you know, 2 miles wide and 4 miles long that have been there forever. There's a whole conglomeration of these. It had been shrunk down to 15 at one point after Napoleon, because there had been like 80 before. And so Kaiser Wilhelm is the first, we'll put it this way. because of his impetus, he is the one who pushes for the unification of Germany, and it succeeds with a war on two provinces in northern Germany. They're next to the Belgian border, and that's kind of the last group to be brought in. And so it's Bismarck in 1871 who unifies Germany, and as Germany is unified, Kaiser Wilhelm I proclaims himself to be the German emperor and declares the Second Reich. So when Adolf comes along later and declares the Third Reich, this is the second. And it's during the end of this Prussian-Franco war, while in the Hall of Mirrors in Versailles Palace, it's there in France, in Versailles, that Wilhelm I declares himself to be the Emperor of the Reich. So add insult number two from Germany to France. Very little regard for the French, for Bismarck to orchestrate this and for Wilhelm to do this. And so the French become increasingly angered and feel impotent as a nation to do anything about this. And Germany, on the other hand, now enters into not only unification, but a period of sustained economic growth and a corresponding rise in militarism, so that it's not long before Germany actually passes Great Britain as an industrial power and is beginning even to challenge the United States. So Germany becomes this engine of economic and material progress. And you know, some of the great German companies we know of come out of that period in time. What's the big manufacturing company still around today? It's the German equivalent of General Electric. I forget the name. Siemens. Yeah, all these companies get started and are thriving in Germany at this time. And you get a sense that once Germany's unified, this thing's going to take off. This is going to become a major, not only European power, but a world power. Kaiser Wilhelm II becomes German emperor in 1881 after Kaiser Wilhelm dies. Wilhelm II becomes the emperor, and his first act is to push the now elderly and curmudgeonly Bismarck out of office. Otto von Bismarck is a very interesting figure because he is a professing evangelical. He read German pietist literature, German Christian literature. On his bedside, he had his Bible, and then some of the pietist theologians apparently, you know, underlined and stuff. So he, when he found his bride-to-be, he had to go to her father and pass the Christian orthodoxy test and basically give his personal testimony to her, to her dad, so that he would grant okay. So there's this Christian and kind of an evangelical sense about Bismarck in theory that never shows itself in public. Bismarck is a bombastic, gluttonous, how you describe him, autocratic. No one in Europe can stand dealing with him. The British Prime Minister, I think it was Disraeli, said, "I don't trust that man. He means what he says." There's a sense in which Bismarck is the real power in European politics. The bad part is you have to deal with him. The good part is there's going to be peace because it's not in Bismarck's interest for war. And so once Bismarck's pushed out, that kind of destabilizes the foreign offices and the state departments of these various nations. You knew what you were going to get with him. Everything was going to be pro-German. The guy who was going to throw you in the mat and twist your arm, and he was going to be a pain to deal with, but there would be peace and order. Not so anymore once Bismarck is forced out. Kaiser Wilhelm II, as I mentioned, is a bit unstable. He's got a hot hair-trigger temper. He's considered reckless. One of the most reckless things ever is the Zimmermann telegram that gets to from Ambassador so-and-so in Germany to Zimmermann in Mexico during the heat of the World War, advocating that, you know, if Mexico would create trouble in the southwest United States, perhaps even invade militarily, then we would make sure that you get Mexico and Texas back after we win the war. So this becomes public knowledge in the White House, and that's kind of the last straw that leads to the American declaration of war on Germany. Now, the background there is before this telegram is sent, I think it's 1917, Woodrow Wilson had to deal with our friend Pancho Villa, and there were these military incursions from the United States into Mexico, from Mexico into the United States. There's lots of killing, and General Pershing is sent to Mexico to clean up Pancho Villa and to put an end to this, and he does, which is why Pershing becomes kind of a favorite of Wilson later and is appointed the, I forget his exact title, it is the, not field commander, but it's the American equivalent of a field marshal, and Pershing is the highest ranking general in U.S. history until Washington's given the same honor posthumously. So if you ask who was the highest ranking general ever in American history, it's Black Jack Pershing. And Washington was given that same title later because you couldn't have, you know, him left out. So Wilhelm is a difficult person to deal with. He was never seen out of uniform, which should have scared all of Europe from the very beginning. He blamed British doctors for a withered arm. He was born with a very withered arm. You see him all the time. He has his hand in his pocket. You never see him move the one arm, and he's very self-conscious about this. And he had tenuous mental health that he blamed upon this delivery that he was apparently botched, and so he was fits of depression and things like that. He's an anti-Semite. He calls the Jews, quoting, a menace that humanity must get rid of some way or other. I believe the best thing would be gas. So this is, you know, way before World War I. He gave a disastrous interview to a British reporter, the Daily Telegraph, in 1908. And he starts rambling as though he'd had too many scotches or something. And he blames all of the problems in the world on Britain and France and Russia and Japan, whiny, complaining. And it was a kind of thing that put all of the other world powers on the defensive thing, and this guy is just a loose cannon, and he was. And it was such a poor performance that he lost all popular support in Germany. And when he abdicates at the end of World War I, I mean, there's a reason for it. The German people had really lost confidence in him, and it started with this Daily Telegraph interview in 1908. Meanwhile, Tsar Nicholas II takes the throne of Russia in 1894. He's the first cousin of Kaiser Wilhelm, as I mentioned. And the peak between Wilhelm II and Nicholas II begins when Nicholas doesn't renew a previous peace treaty that his predecessor had carved out with the Germans under Bismarck. And this treaty would have, I don't understand the ramifications of it thoroughly. You have to do a PhD in European diplomacy to understand all of these treaties, especially in the early 19th century on. Apparently this treaty would have served as kind of a pressure valve to let Germany or Russia out of agreements had either one of them gone to war. And when that treaty is not renewed, it puts this rigid treaty system in place without an escape valve that ultimately blows up along the lines we saw in the film. We'll talk about that momentarily. But Russia, from the time Nicholas becomes Tsar on, begins to cast an eye on the Ottoman Empire and territories that Germany desires. The one thing, if you look at the map of Russia, that Russia does not have, that Russia has wanted as long as it's been a modern nation, is what? An exit out of the Black Sea and access to the Mediterranean. That because the other ports in the north are frozen half the year, Murmansk, Vladivostok is way too far on the other side to be of any value. So Russia is always looking for a Mediterranean port. They see the Dardanelles, that strait that leads out of the Black Sea through what's now Turkey in the Mediterranean, as a strategic need for the Soviet economy, Russian economy, because they can exit the Black Sea, they can control oil in what's now Hungary and Romania, a lot of oil there, mineral-rich countries that, you know, they can now negotiate with, conquer perhaps, and export. And that begins to create this tension we see between Russia and the Austro-Hungarian Empire over places like Romania, Bulgaria. The Russians and the Austrians are kind of trying to ally these. And it's basically Russia's desire, look, if we could somehow get Constantinople, the capital of Turkey, the Ottoman Empire, if we could get that and an access to the Dardanelles, our geopolitical situation is going to greatly improve. So Russia's maneuvering all along trying to secure that. That's the ultimate goal. An unspoken factor in the start of the war is the death of Queen Victoria. She's utterly remarkable. She was called the grandmother of Europe. She dies in 1901. 34 of her grandchildren live to adulthood, including royals in the Spanish, Norwegian, Swedish, and Denmark royal families. She contributed husbands and wives to all of these royal empires in those four nations. Her grandson, King George V, ruled Great Britain during the war. Again, first cousin of Nicholas II and of Nicholas's wife, Alexandria, who is German. If you know this story, you know that the English royals are actually Germans. Too long to discuss, but he's anyway. Nicholas and his wife are not first cousins, but they're both first cousins to King George V. How that works, you'll have to look at the chart on Wikipedia. It's pretty complicated, but it's true. Kaiser Wilhelm's a first cousin, but even as kids when they play together, Wilhelm was despised by both George V and Nicholas. They just hated him. And there was the, I can't remember the line, Queen Elizabeth said something about Wilhelm II, that he was going to grow up to be trouble or he needed discipline or something to that effect. And that's kind of a famous quote that is attached to Wilhelm later on. And Wilhelm resents the British his whole life. If Germany hadn't gone to war with England, he would have found a way because of his animosity towards all things British. The other thing that kind of pushes the Soviet Union along is this disastrous war that Russia fights with Japan in 1904-1905. Over on the Pacific side of Russia, over the territory of Manchuria, Russia just assumes the Japanese are going to be a pushover. The Japanese absolutely romp on the Russian army, embarrass them badly, and at the Battle of Tsushima, the Japanese fleet wipes out a much larger and on paper superior German fleet. And this is the beginning of Japan's rise as a naval power at Tsushima in 1904. The thing that characterizes the Russian-Sino War of 1904 is the Japanese entrance into that war. And we know how it happened. The Japanese, 3 hours before attacking the Russians, sent them a telegraph that we're declaring war on you. That was the model for the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, which is why the Japanese ambassador was in Washington getting his last thing to go hand to the State Department. Only they were late doing the translation. The machine kept breaking down. So by the time they had the declaration of war, Pearl Harbor had already been bombed, which infuriated the United States to no end and probably ended up keeping the United States aggressive enough to drop two atomic bombs on Japan. I mean, that outrage from that diplomatic nightmare really had a great impact on the outcome of World War II. So the Soviets, the Russians, I'm going to have to keep calling them the Soviets. I'm a child of the 50s and 60s. I can't help myself. They were commies, all I knew. The Russian war in Japan was a real humiliation, and that puts Russia on the fast track to militarizing, general placing, that whole thing, which will factor in greatly in their decision to mobilize. I think one of the major problems in this period is the Schlieffen Plan. In 1905, German military planners, Germany's, as you know, is just this martial military mentality in Prussia, then in Germany. German generals were smart to realize that if we have to fight a two-front war, you can saw from the map, you've got Russia on the one side with about 5 million soldiers when mobilized. That's not a small army. And you have France on the other side looking for revenge. So if Germany goes to war, and Germany has to fight a two-front war, they're going to have a really tough time. And if you know anything about World War II, you know that Germany's generals were having a fit when Hitler decided he wanted to invade the Soviet Union in 1940. The generals were like, no, don't do it. Remember what happened. So the Schlieffen Plan was put in place in 1905 so that Germany would not fight a two-front war, at least would fight one front at a time. Germany planned to hold off Russia on its eastern frontier on the assumption that Russia's army was so big and inefficient it was going to take them a long time to mobilize. As I mentioned last time, you know, when these countries issue a declaration of mobilization, they have to requisition horses and mules and things like food and clothing. It takes a while to get enough material to the depots to be packaged and distributed to the soldiers. This is a huge undertaking. Even things as complicated as arranging railroad lines so that you can get enough capacity to move armies. It's a major thing. And the Germans assume that the Russians are going to take forever to do this. And so we'll hold Russia off. Meanwhile, we're going to put the bulk of our forces and go after France and do to them what we did in 1870. We're going to cut through the northern part of France behind Paris, that flanking maneuver, and we'll knock France out. And once France has capitulated, then we'll go back and fight the Russians. And the Schlieffen Plan is considered by a number of people to be the reason why Germany started the war, that the Schlieffen Plan was just mechanically implemented, and so you got to blame Germany for having the Schlieffen Plan. That position is pretty well, it's put in the context of a lot more factors than just German militarism. The next thing we have to talk about is the rise of European nationals, and we could do a whole hour on some of the subsets here, but most of the European nations that are familiar to us, that we speak of, Germany, Italy, even Spain, are of relative modern origins. I mean, Germany is not a republic until 1871. It's a bunch of little states dominated by Prussia. Italy, if you look at a map of Italy in the 1860s, is a whole bunch of little duchies and isn't even really a nation of Italy until the 1870s. So a lot of the countries that we speak of as European powers are relatively recent, and they're all searching for kind of a national identity and a national purpose and an ethos. Then you've got long-standing countries, Britain and France, trying to defend their empires and arguing along the lines of a divine right to do so. The British, of course, have this great colonial empire in India and still in Canada at this point in time. Significant interest in this new thing called the Suez Canal and a reason to occupy Egypt. So you've got this nationalism going on. Simultaneously, you have the competitive efforts of all these European nations to colonize Africa and the subcontinent in Asia. And this is driven by the quest for natural resources. The Industrial Revolution is, you know, now and beyond anything that was envisioned even 100 years earlier. And so you need foodstuffs, grain, all that. You need timber. Lumber is an especially rare commodity. You've got places in, for example, the Indies where you get mahogany and other kinds of rare wood. All that stuff is in demand. Rubber, we have this new invention, the automobile. We need tires. You can only get rubber from very few places in warm climates. And then, of course, the other one being things like quinine and other medicines that you don't find naturally in Europe. So there's this huge demand to build these giant colonial empires. And the tragedy here is these empires are built with a unashamed racism of Northern Europeans toward those who are not the same. We could spend a lot of time on social Darwinism and the impact that Darwin's approach to natural selection has when applied to nations. You get a sense in these European capitals that Europeans have superior culture, Europeans know better, that Europeans have kind of a natural right to these things. We'll build them railroads, we'll give them governments, and we'll Christianize them, but their stuff is really our stuff. In Germany, you get that through the lens of kind of a Hegelian twist that, as the Hegelians in Germany are, you've got this comprehensive way to understand the history as a outworking of a thesis, an antithesis, and a synthesis. And so you apply the kind of the Darwinian categories of evolution to this, and you get this sense in which, all of history is moving toward an end, and that end is going to be driven by the superiority of Europe. So at the same time, you have in Europe things like the charts that we have all seen in history books, where you get the Africa's new, and you see gorillas, and so you see the evolution of the apes, and the lowest part of the human evolutionary thing is a figure that looks very much like an African. And then that goes on to be whiter and whiter and more upright. And you get the connection between apes and certain racial groups. I mean, it's just abominable when you think about it. That's the kind of stuff going on. You have a whole phrenology, a whole science devoted to looking at people's heads and measuring their head shapes and sizes and trying to figure out their... And there's all this bizarre stuff going on. It's not mainstream, but it's part of this social Darwinism going on in Europe, where in the State Departments and in the admiralties and in the political parlors of Europe, they're thinking, we really have a right to this because we're superior. And that leads, of course, to this colonialism and this idea that the Europeans have a right to whatever they can take in Africa and Asia and so on. Coupled with the colonialism is an arms race. England has modern technologies we saw last time with the development of the Dreadnought, which is a steam-powered armored warship with revolving gun turrets. It's the kind of the first in that line was the Monitor from the Civil War. By now you've got 40 years. The first Dreadnought's 1904, I think. So you've got a modern weapon now. The British, with this large empire, have to build the world's best navy. They do. Kaiser Wilhelm sees it and is so green with envy that he decides to match the British ship for ship, and does. And so Germany's building this massive navy. The French get involved. The Russians build several capital ships. Even the Austrians build several ships that perform very poorly during the war. So this massive arms race is going on. In Africa, in several places, the British have experimented with a Vickers water-cooled machine gun. The Maxim gun is used in Mexico. Machine guns are being tried out and used. It's apparent how devastating they're going to be. Better artillery, the howitzer, the exploding shell, packaged ammunition, all that stuff. It's the weapons of war are becoming incredibly deadly. Next on the line, as the movie makes clear, is the Balkan conflict. And again, you could spend hours trying to understand this. There are entire courses in political theory devoted to the history of the Balkans and what goes right and what goes wrong there. But the Balkan conflict, as we saw, draws the Russians, because the Russians are allied with the Slavs, and the Austrians, who are allied with Bosnia, they just had annexed it. That brings their attention. The Austro-Hungarian Empire and the Russians are watching the Balkans closely, and the desire, again, is for territory. The Ottoman Empire is collapsing. Russia sees this as a way to get finally into the Mediterranean and the Black Sea. In the back rooms, the Russians are trying to make deals with everybody to get a Balkan state on the Adriatic Sea. So their real desire is to get out to the Mediterranean, and they're seeing that the Balkans might provide them with that. The Austro-Hungarians are thinking, if we control Bosnia, we can keep Serbia at bay. And as the movie makes clear, one of the things that the Archduke was actually going to propose was a Balkan state added to the Austro-Hungarian Empire that would be called Yugoslavia. Put those together, make one nation, and give them equal status. And as the Austro-Hungarian Empire had done previously, Franz Joseph had made himself both emperor of the Habsburgs, therefore of Austria, also the king of Hungary. And he probably could have added, his successor could have added a third royal crown to this Balkan state. So Austro-Hungary, at least the Archduke is thinking that way. Franz Joseph certainly wasn't. But the Youngers were thinking, you know, maybe this is a way to end that conflict. But everybody's looking at the Balkans. And then we have, I think the real issue here is the alliance system. If you go back to the years after Napoleon had done his invasion of all of Europe and brought havoc everywhere, his nephew, Napoleon III, and the Austrian foreign minister Metternich had done a very good job of keeping the peace in Europe and putting in an alliance system so that there were mutual assurances of cooperation, all kinds of things. And so that starts this idea of putting in place this hard system of alliances, which by the time of World War I becomes the dominoes that are going to go and lead to war. Now, the first alliance that's in place is the alliance with Russia and Serbia. Serbia being a Balkan state, Russia looking at that state and thinking, we will ally with you if you get in trouble with Austria. If you have a fight with Austria, we guarantee military aid. So that's the first alliance. It's kind of hard and fast and set in place, Russia and Serbia. Germany and Austro-Hungary, Germany had promised the Austro-Hungarians that if there is a war to come, we will provide you with material support. But as we saw, Kaiser Wilhelm never really fleshed out what all that support entailed. And so he's not even really aware of what's going on in the first 2 weeks of the war in the Balkans. He's off on his yacht in the Baltic sailing around with very little idea and very little care, while his general staff is kind of taking the ball and running with it. So Germany and Austria-Hungary promised to support Austria if Austria is attacked by Russia. So you can just see one domino, now a second. France and Russia have had long-standing treaties motivated by their mutual animosity toward Germany. So France and Russia, which, you know, that's an odd alliance to me. You read about the diplomatic stuff going on in this time in St. Petersburg, the capital of Russia. All the diplomatic correspondence is conducted in what language? French. That just boggles my mind. I'm not a Francophile, if you can kind of gather that. But France and Russia have a long-standing mutual relationship, including the exchanging of royal family members, and they're both motivated by their fear of Germany. And then Britain, France, and Belgium have an odd alliance from a peace treaty in the 1830s, I believe, that established a new European country, a country known as Belgium. And in the event that anybody violated Belgian neutrality or attacks France, Britain had pledged to come to their aid. So Britain has this treaty agreement that, as we saw, didn't require them to get in the war, except if Belgium territory, their neutrality was violated, which Germany did on, I think it was August 4th. So we'll look at that in just a minute. So I think different, I think contrary to the movie, I think there is a sense in which the British were obligated by that treaty to come to Belgium's aid. And then there's another treaty that we don't think much about, but has big ramifications, a treaty between Britain and Japan, brought about by their mutual interests in what country? China. So it's hard for us to realize, but there are huge British interests in China. Almost all the Protestant missions in China to that time were conducted by the British, the Presbyterian. A lot of Christian work being done in the mission field in China. And Japan now perceived as a kind of a strategic player now that they defeated the Russians. And there were lots of Western interests in China, and Britain and Japan had agreed to support each other in the event of a war with Germany, which didn't seem like it could ever happen, does it? So all of this creates this very rigid system of alliances in which if you push one domino over, you're going to have a world war in your hands very quickly. And that's exactly what happens. How does a war begin? Well, there are a lot of timelines here, but I wanted to walk you through, not that we need to know all the particulars, but just to get a sense of the dates and how quick this happens. There are probably 30 of these on the internet. I pulled one down. And I want to look at the dates and the events from June 28th through the end of August 1914. So that is what? Say 10 weeks. So from August backwards to June 28th, those 10 weeks, we can see just by going through these dates and what happens, how quickly this thing got out of hand. It's like, remember the brush fire a couple years ago in San Diego County? You know, San Diego has this kind of a alluvial plain tilt, so you've got mountains in the center sloping down to the coast with scrub brush, and so when you get the wind right, you have this hot winds blowing fire downhill and just kind of scorching everything. It's when the seminary almost got damaged by the fire. That's kind of what the situation is in Europe, just waiting for somebody to flick the match on it. I mean, the thing is ripe for a fire. It's just going to happen, and the question is how. So, on June 28th, Archduke Franz Ferdinand, the heir to the Austro-Hungarian Empire, as we saw, is killed in Sarajevo by Gavrilo Princip. Princip's trying to keep Austria out of the Balkans. He wants to see a united Balkan state. The Black Hand Party, of which he's part, is advocating for a Balkan state. And so his act, ironically, guarantees an Austrian invasion. Now, that's one of those providential things you wonder about the mysterious purposes of God. Here's one. As shown in the film, one of these Black Hand assassins throws a bomb. It was a forerunner of a modern hand grenade. It hits the hood of the car, bounces, rolls into the car behind it, blows up, and injures a couple of the security guards and one of the officials. So after the ceremony at the mayor's office in Sarajevo, which is on the film, that's the last time you ever see the Archduke and his wife alive. They complain, you know, we come to visit, you throw a bomb at us. So he changes plans immediately and says, I want to go see the people that were hurt. So there are no plans for a motorcade, there are no directions. The driver takes them toward the hospital and tries to take a shortcut and enters a one-way street. That particular car doesn't have a reverse gear. So they're trying to do a three-point turn, and here walks Prinkip with his sandwich. He's in town to make an attempt on the Archduke's life, and of course it's all over. They missed, he's discouraged, and there he is, 10 feet away. And so he pulls out his Browning and shoots him twice, and shoots the Archduke's wife. So you just think, whoa. July 5th, a week later, Austro-Hungary seeks German support for war against Serbia in case of Russian aggression. So Germany then, of course, pledges support. July 23rd, this is almost a month now, Austro-Hungary sends an ultimatum to Serbia, and that ultimatum is something Serbia could never meet, but if there is any legitimate complaint in the opening part of World War I, it is the fact that our Archduke was assassinated in your country by one of your guys. What are you going to do about it, Serbia? This is something you instigate. I mean, this is probably the only actual case of some sort of mandate for retaliation or some action to be taken. So they send an ultimatum to Serbia. The Serbian response is considered unsatisfactory. On July 31st, July 28th, that's what, 7 days later, Austro-Hungary declares war upon Serbia. So we're looking at just at a month after this starts before Austria declares war on Serbia. And the minute Austria does that, the Tsar orders a Russian mobilization. So as I mentioned, a mobilization is a huge thing. This involves, you know, all of this paperwork, all the securing of animals, all the reserves have to leave their home. It's a huge national undertaking during this period. So Russia begins that process. Germany sees the clock running. If Russia's mobilizing and the Schlieffen plan's going to be put into effect, we got to get going. So Russia orders a general mobilization on the 20th. On the 31st, Germany warns Russia to stop. That's the two telegrams back and forth between Kaiser Wilhelm and his cousin Nicholas II. Russia says mobilization is a response to what the Hungarians, the Austro-Hungarians are doing. August 1st, Germany declares war on Russia. So 5 weeks after the Archduke is killed, Germany actually declares war on Russia. Italy, who had been allied with the Triple Alliance, pulls out. Central Powers pulls out. And on that day, August 1st, Germany signs a secret agreement with the Ottoman Empire. So now think about this. Think of the size of this thing. From Austria, Serbia, now all of a sudden we have Russia and Germany and the Ottoman Empire pulled in. And we're 5 weeks out. On August 2nd, Germany invades Luxembourg. The Schlieffen plan's underway. And you have the first military action on the Western Front, a skirmish at a French city called Jean-Charie. It's the first time the French and the Germans actually shoot at each other. Between August 2nd and August 26th, in accordance with the Schlieffen plan, Germany besieges and then captures a fortification, Longwy, which was called the Iron Gate to Paris from the first invasion in 1871. It's near the Luxembourg border. This is the highway into France for the German army, and they begin to secure that, and that involves taking a number of roads and bridges and so on, moving the railway line. The German had train tracks were a different gauge. They had to re-gauge the railroads and all that to get everything ready to go. But they're already making that quick effort to invade France. August 3rd, Germany declares war on France. So one day after they institute the Schlieffen Plan, they declare war on France, and Belgium denies permissions for the Germans to cross. So you can see the dominoes just starting to go. August 4th, Germany invades Belgium, a neutral country, to outflank the French. Britain protests the violation of Belgian neutrality, guaranteed by a treaty. And Kaiser Wilhelm replies that the treaty is just a chiffon de papier, a scrap of paper. And so Britain declares war on Germany, and what do? Wilson declares neutrality. So we declare official neutrality on August 4th, 1914. Between August 4 and 16, the Germans besieged and captured the fortresses of Liège in Belgium. So the Germans are well underway. The Schlieffen Plan is really rolling. The Belgian military strong point is captured. And all kinds of German atrocities began in the Belgian people. A number of the Belgian farmers were in the woods sniping at the German army marching along, killing their horses and shooting at the officers. And the Germans began to retaliate by killing civilians. And they, when they capture Louvain, they burn down the classic library in the city and begin to commit all kinds of horrible atrocities. And that factors in here shortly. The first shot fired by Allied troops was on August 5th. A German steamer, the FS Falls, surrendered after being fired upon by Fort Napon in Melbourne, Australia. So now think how the first Allied really shot at the Germans is in Melbourne, of all places. This is how fast this is spreading. Montenegro declares war on Austria-Hungary. Montenegro is this little tiny mountainous thing in on the Adriatic Sea. They declare war on Austria-Hungary. And the Ottoman Empire that day closes the Dardanelles. It's getting to be bad. August 6th, Austria-Hungary declares war on Russia. Serbia declares war on Germany. And on that very day, Woodrow Wilson's beloved wife, Ellen, dies of Bright's disease. So, as you may know, I'm not a big fan of Woodrow Wilson, but he is in a terrible strait these days. He is grieving. And it's going to take Wilson a while to kind of regain his footing and his bearings. August 7th, the British Expeditionary Force arrives in France. So, how far out are we? June 28th to August 7th, the British Army is beginning to cross the channel and enter France and take positions. August 7th to 10th, the Battle of Mulhouse, which is on the Swiss-French-German border where they all come together. France captures it. Germany takes it right back, which will kind of be a pattern to follow the rest of the war. Montenegro, this tiny little mountainous thing, declares war on Germany. That same day, the Togoland campaign begins. Where's Togoland? Togoland is the German colony next to Nigeria on the African coast. They're fighting in Africa now over colonies. We're 5 weeks out. August 11th, France declares war on Austro-Hungary. So the French are in it now on all sides. And the next day, Great Britain declares war on Austria-Hungary. The 16th to the 19th, the Serbs, the little Serbian army defeats this massive Austrian army at the Battle of Sura, which we showed, that the Austrian army is huge, more concerned about the uniforms, the appearance of the soldiers marching than the tactics. If you look at the Austrian uniforms, I mean, they're like the French. They had these wonderfully piped units and hats and all of that, and they got their army bloodied in the Battle of Sura. August 17th, the Russian army enters Prussia. August 20, the Germans attack the Russians in East Prussia, kind of a counterattack to hold them off. That day, the Germans capture almost all of Belgium, including Brussels. August 22nd, Austria-Hungary declares war on Belgium. So every day, there's just a new... Between August 23rd and August 30th, the Battle of Tannenberg. Russian army suffers, has to be one of the most humiliating and serious defeats in military history. The Germans in that week killed, captured, or wounded 250,000 Russian soldiers. That's a famous monument, by the way, that the Germans built after World War I, where Hitler does all of his celebratory stuff. There in Nuremberg, at Tannenberg, and when the Russians begin to invade Germany in World War II, Hitler destroys the monument at Tannenberg so that Stalin can't make political hay of it. 250,000 killed in a week-long battle. So Europe's beginning to get a sense of how bad this is going to be. August 23rd, the Battle of Lemberg, it's in Poland now. Russians capture Lviv. Battle of Krasnik, a phase of this battle. The Austro-Hungarian Empire defeats the Russian Fourth Army. Again, huge numbers of casualties on both sides, into the hundreds of thousands. Between August 24 and 28, the Allied retreat. across France and Europe back to the River Marne. So you look at the map of northern France. France is just, and the British are just pulling back everywhere. The Germans are aggressive, rapidly advancing. Next day, Japan declares war on Austria-Hungary. So it's just August 26th, the British and the French capture Togoland, a German protectorate in West Africa. So next day, August 27th, the Battle of Tsing Sao. British and Japanese forces capture a German-controlled port in China. August 28th, the Royal Navy fights its first battle at Helgoland Bight in North Sea. So this is the first naval battle. Now we're fighting in the North Sea as well. And August 30th, New Zealand occupies German Samoa. So within, 9 weeks, the whole of the world is at war. So this truly is a world war. And it gets started in just this, like I said, it's like a brush fire. It just spreads and nobody knows what to do. And as the film identified, if you were to ask a German, a French or a Russian soldier, what are you fighting for? They would go, I don't know. We were attacked, I think. So who started what is truly a world war? Well, most historians blame Kaiser Wilhelm II and his generals due to their rigid adherence to the Schlieffen Plan and for this German militarism. The theory is that the Germans pressured Austria-Hungary into invading Serbia. That view is enshrined in the Treaty of Versailles, which we'll talk about next week. Popular writers like David Fromkin in his book Europe's Last Summer make that case. It's kind of the received position. There is some strength to it, but I think it's much more complicated than that. Another group of historians blame Nicholas II for issuing the order to mobilize his armies, because when Nicholas mobilizes the Russian army, he knows that the Schlieffen Plan is going to have to go into effect. I mean, as soon as he says mobilize, he knows what Germany's going to do. A third group blamed France, because France was looking for a way to regain the Alsace-Lorraine, and France was making assurances diplomatically to Russia this whole time that if you mobilize, we and the British will support you if Germany attacks. So the French have a lot of reasons why they want to egg the Russians on, because they want an excuse to go to war with Germany again and regain the Alsace. That's the French diplomatic mind. Then you have the Balkan fighting as portrayed in the film, the intrigue produced by groups like Black Hand and Gavriil Princip. He's the guy that lights the match, but the Austro-Hungarian Empire, their house is on fire. The empire's doomed to collapse. You've got an old king. You've got no popular heir. You have this unstable ethnic political foundation. So Balkan intrigue is a fourth cause. And Christopher Clark, in his book called Sleepwalking, I think is exactly right when he says, and I'm quoting from Clark here, "The outbreak of the war in 1914 is not an Agatha Christie drama at the end of which we discover the culprit standing over a corpse in the conservatory with a smoking pistol. There is no smoking gun in this story, or rather, there is one in the hands of every major character. Viewed in this light, the outbreak of war was a tragedy, not a crime. Acknowledging this does not mean we should minimize the belligerence and imperialist paranoia of the Austrian and Germany policymakers, but the Germans were not the only imperialists and not the only ones to succumb to paranoia. The crisis that brought war in 1914 was the fruit of a shared political culture." And I think he's absolutely right. If you're at all interested in the way in which World War I got started, Christopher Clark's book, Sleepwalking, is the book to read. It's really stellar. You just come away thinking, what a mess. Everybody did the worst possible thing. Well, what are the geopolitical lessons to be learned? Well, the most important is that regional conflicts can escalate really quickly, because within 1 week of the Archduke's assassination, there are 17 million men from 8 different nations ready to go to war with one another. It's incredible. So the questions that are raised for us, what happens if China attacks Taiwan, or if China attacks Japan, or what if China sinks an American naval vessel? What if Russia and Ukraine go to war? What about North Korea attacking South Korea, or Iran and Hezbollah attacking Israel, or vice versa? And these are the kind of flashpoints in our world that can end up with consequences just like that before World War I. And it's why we have treaties. It's why we have alliances like NATO. It's why the UN, if in principle, certainly not in reality, provides this kind of stability to keep those things from happening. But that's a geopolitical question. The question I want to conclude with tonight is, how did European and American Christians react to the start of the war? And how do we as Christians look at something like this conflagration in which you have Christian nations declaring war on other Christian nations in the name of Christ? What do we do with this? Well, remember that all of the principal nations here are part of a larger European Christendom, and all of them consider themselves to be Christian nations. But that didn't stop them from invoking God's wrath against each other, and some even saw the Great War as an opportunity to remake the world in their progressive or nationalist image. And that's the theme we're going to talk about in our fourth lecture and also in our time of discussion in Jenkins' book, because that's the issue that Jenkins is really wrestling with in the opening parts of the book. And I've heard from many of you that you're really enjoying the book, and this is really going to be a thorny question he's going to raise, and we're going to have to discuss it, and we will. Now, one of the things that we have to consider here is that Christians have a very well-developed criteria for just war. In classical Christian ethical teaching, we have very concrete principles in place to consider when situations like this arise. This just war theory was all but ignored by all the Christian leaders of Europe. And just war theory is pretty stable. The goal is always peace, the vindication of justice. You fight a war not to conquer, you fight a war to regain the peace. The second principle of just war is the state uses its legitimate authority in exercising force to defend its people. War is primarily a defensive thing, to defend your people and your national interests. A third element is there must be a formal declaration of war. And that, by the way, is enshrined in our Constitution. One of the big bugaboos in modern American political theory is we've had presidents go to war without a declaration of war, and that ought to be something that ought to be talked about, because it's not only part of just war theory, it's also part of our constitutional representative Republican government. Four, the purpose for which a war is fought must be just. So I think you can make the case that the Revolutionary War is going to be really tough to justify using just war theory. World War II is a slam dunk. Yes, it is covered by just war theory. And those are debates that Christians have had for many, many years. Fifth, war must always be a last resort. Never the first action, always the last action, always entered into reluctantly. Six, violence cannot be directed toward non-combatants. So think of the issues in World War II with Sir Arthur Harris, the head of the British Bomber Command, bombing Hamburg. What do you do with the United States making a decision to not only drop nuclear weapons on twice upon Japan, but also upon firebombing Tokyo, and more people were killed in the firebombing of Tokyo than were actually killed in the two nuclear bombs dropped at Nagasaki and Hiroshima? I mean, those are questions that Christians have thought about. Can you direct violence toward non-combatants? And there are subsets in just war theory that allow you to do this under very specific and rigid conditions. So, I mean, even Aquinas had wrestled with this and had dealt with this question. And seven, minimum force must be used to attain the goal. You don't use maximum force, you use the force necessary to achieve. And this would be very much enshrined in, say, the Colin Powell doctrine before the Iraq War, that you use the force necessary to win, get out, be done. That fits very nicely with just war theory. The irony here is Christian nations ignoring traditional Christian teaching about just war. Why is that? Well, I think it's a sign of the triumph of Christian nationalism and this full-blown and heretical form of Christianity, which we call civil religion. And we're going to talk about this again in Lecture 4 and as we discuss the Jenkins book. The danger of Christian nationalism is especially great when Christians grow accustomed and used to invoking holy war themes from the Old Testament to justify military action or imperialism in the present. You can always tell Christian nationalism when you hear politicians say, God is on our side, or our cause is the Lord's cause. Why? Because we're God's people. That's why. And European Christians in this amorphous Christendom had embraced that ideology for centuries. This is a long-standing hangover from the Crusades. It's patently unbiblical because Christ fulfilled the Mosaic economy. And so classical Augustinian and Protestant two-kingdom theology contends that you can't appeal to the Mosaic economy beyond general equity for the model of modern civil government. I mean, if you read Scripture properly, Israel occupies a unique role in redemptive history. It's fulfilled by the coming of Christ. Therefore, we can't go back to Old Testament law and stone people and declare holy wars on the Canaanites. Christian nations can't go to war against Amalekites today. It's forbidden by the way in which Israel plays a unique role in a particular period in redemptive history. We can look at the way Israel functioned in the Promised Land for a general equity. In other words, the way in which they treated aliens and widows and poor, those kinds of things, would provide effective ways of helping us govern ourselves today, but we can't go back and appeal to theocratic case law for modern law. Calvin said as much in the Institutes. He was very clear about it. Therefore, it's much better for Christians to think in different categories, such as our national cause is a righteous cause, which is far better than saying that our cause is God's cause. We ought to be very careful about invoking particular national blessings. You know, God is on our side, but we're to trust instead his providential judgments. We don't have any biblical justification for claiming God's national blessing. And in fact, it may even be God's will that certain nations perish or diminish in their political national influence. But Christians can and certainly ought to acknowledge the political and military realities and necessities faced by our nation, and we can appeal to God for help without invoking God's particular favor. And then in light of Romans 13, you know, Christians can't ignore the limits in the rule of law imposed by things like constitutions or treaties or charters, nor should we advocate violations of long-standing tenets of just war theory. And we have a colossal case of Christians failing to act like Christians at the start of this war in mass. And it's kind of one of those things you look at and you just, every argument that non-Christians raise kind of come to light in the light of this miserable situation. But it is brought about by Christian nationalism. Well, what do you mean by that? Let's look at some specific examples. One of the best is Adolf von Harnack. Von Harnack was born in 1851. He dies in 1930. He's a very prominent Lutheran theologian, an eminent church historian. If you do any kind of PhD work in church history, you have to read Harnack's History of Dogma. It's like the standard critical approach to the development of Christian doctrine. Harnack is also the advocate of what was called the social gospel, which is a form of Christianity that focused upon social justice issues. So anybody doing social justice today would be very much along the lines of Harnack's social gospel. He's widely read and appreciated by American progressives at this time, both in the church and without, and especially known for his views on the kingdom of God, which he defined as the universal fatherhood of God, the universal brotherhood of his children in love for one another, a kingdom that sadly has no mention of a cross or a resurrection, a kingdom that is purely ethical and internal. So you're never going to hear Harnack talking about the kingdom of God advancing and tied to the death of Christ for sin, nor from the empty tomb and the resurrection. The kingdom of God is purely ethical. It's what is within you. It's just that you love your brothers and sisters. Rather ironic, isn't it? Because Harnack was privy counselor to Wilhelm II from 1902 on. Harnack was Wilhelm II's ear. He was like Billy Graham to American presidents, only even more so. He was the theologian to whom Kaiser Wilhelm II looked for justification. And he was made chair of the Kaiser Wilhelm Foundation, making Harnack the primary figure in the German academic world, which is a really impressive role because the German academic reputation was stellar, second to none. Every American theologian did doctorates in Germany. You went to Britain if you couldn't get into Germany. Highly regarded. Along with 93 other German academics, Harnack signed a public document that endorsed Germany's war aims called the Manifesto of the 93. And in that document, Harnack and company denied any German war atrocities, especially those in Belgium, which it was clear the Germans had actually committed. And Harnack, in several sermons, considered the German army as the, quote, militia of Christ. So Karl Barth is mentioned in Jenkins' book as someone who rejected liberal theology because of the signatures by many of his professors on the Treaty of the 90, the Manifesto of the 93. Barth saw this and thought this was a complete capitulation to culture and politics, and therefore a serious weakening of the Christian faith. And we've discussed Barth at length in our reading of Mike Horton's book, and we see we have, you know, at least I do, a kind of a love-hate relationship with Barth. But you have to give him courage for this. What are American Christians doing? Well, progressives, by the way, who agreed with Harnack and were reading Harnack regularly on theological issues, they saw the Great War through the lens of progress. And they describe it as a conflict between good and evil. Richard Gamble, in his stellar book, The War for Righteousness, which is on the bibliography, I really encourage you all, this is, if you're going to read one sleeper book, this one and maybe Christopher Clark's book would be the two I would really recommend. But Gamble defines American progressives, quoting here, as eager participants in a world marked by material progress and technological efficiency and by an increasing moral rigor and earnestness in domestic and foreign policy. The progressive clergy imagine themselves, their faith, their nation, as poised on the brink of opportunity, on the verge of an unprecedented chance to serve humanity by spreading America's material, political, and spiritual progress. Gag. And so the scope and ferocity of the Great War was really a shock to the progressive mind. But the progressives, instead of being horrified by it, saw it as an opportunity for progressive agendas and for progressive future in the world. Gamble says, the future for a progressive would be unified, egalitarian, civilized, peaceful, and democratic, which is fine as a political goal, but the church had to prepare the way. And so here we have what is an ethical postmillennialism. It's thoroughly utopian. And this is one of the places where we as classical Augustinian confessional Protestants see this as a gigantic theological problem, because we have a very healthy view of human sin. And our eschatology indicates there is going to be no utopian society this side of the return of Christ. And so these progressives were wanting to see a world characterized by peace. It's John Lennon's Imagine. And so the church has to bring about this utopian postmillennial society. And it's not a postmillennialism like on the Reform side, where Christ's righteousness is going to subdue the nations. It's a postmillennialism brought about by progress. We are getting better as a race and as a people, which is a rejection of the Christian understanding of sin. Now, the greatest irony is that the most vocal of German Christian nationalists in Germany, as Jenkins points out, were the very same theologians who influenced the American progressives. Now, the irony here shouldn't be missed. Quoting Gamble, progressive Christians no longer interpreted the war simply as the collapse of Europe into the pit of economic and military rivalry, but rather the alignment of the world into imperial reality, the one between paganism and Christianity, between the empires of Satan and the empire of God. Notice the language that conservative evangelicals used in the last several American wars against Islam is being used by American progressives against Kaiser Wilhelm. And Kaiser Wilhelm is listening to Adolf von Harnack in his ear, giving him this same kind of language. I hope you can see the irony in this. What is it that transforms the progressive social gospelers of the Central Powers, like Harnack, into pagan dupes of the kingdom of Satan? It's not their theology, because the American progressives believe their theology. So it must be their nationality, or it must be, even worse, their politics. They don't agree with us politically, therefore they are on the side of the devil. The real wake-up call. Now, American evangelicals saw the war in completely different terms. Progressives saw the Great War as an opportunity to reconstruct the churches, America, and the world, says Gamble, according to the imperatives of the social gospel. Their peacetime crusade, you know, prohibition, all the rest of it, their peacetime crusade became a wartime crusade. They transferred all the social activism before the war into the war is going to get us where we need to get, that is to this utopian society where there's world peace and no alcoholism and none of the rest of it. At the same time, this is George Marsden's take on the conservatives, after 1920, conservative evangelical councils, that is all these church meetings, were dominated by fundamentalists engaged in holy warfare. to drive the scourge of modernism out of the church and the culture. So while the progressives saw the progressive causes now applied to the war, fundamentalists use progressive language to now argue we need to drive the progressives out of the American church. So the Holy War is getting rid of the liberals out of the churches. Now, as much as I'm sympathetic to getting rid of liberals out of the churches, that's rather dangerous language. Says Marsden, the progressive activism of the left is now matched by the fundamentalist take America back activism of the right. So if the liberals have taken over, we need to get rid of them and take everything back. And that becomes the language that characterizes much of contemporary evangelical political discourse, is the taking things back from others who stole them from us. And so American culture and politics became a battleground for this liberal progressive left against the so-called fundamentalist, now the Christian right. The classic case of this playing out in American culture is the Scopes trial. Because here you have Scopes teaching evolution, being put on trial and convicted, and the whole time William Jennings Bryan is being made a fool of by everyone in the media. And so Bryan, who was Woodrow Wilson's Secretary of State, and a dear Christian man and a pacifist, is arguing for the doctrines of creation in a very ham-fisted way and becomes the target of ridicule everywhere. Just watch the movie Spencer Tracy and Inherit the Wind and see how the culture saw this. Apart from how Christians saw it, that's how the culture saw it. So what happens is, as a result of World War I, and we'll discuss this issue as it's raised by Jenkins, the progressive left and the Christian right now felt duly bound to impose their religious ideals upon the post-war world. And so the goal of the Christian faith is geopolitical. And that ought to alarm all of us. Well, what do we say by way of conclusion? A couple things here as we wrap up. It's really difficult to determine the precise cause of the Great War, and I'm convinced by Clark's sleepwalking theory that the causes are too complex and multiple to simply blame the Germans. It's not difficult to see that in that war, the complete abandonment, if not the rejection of the very Christian ideals which the Christian nationalists glibly invoked to justify their cause. It's the hypocrisy in this just is off the chart. Christian nations advocating Christian ideals, defending Christian nationalism, waging war on other Christian nations, doing the exact same because they differ politically and their national aims are different. This ensures, ironically, that the next war, World War II, is not going to be a religious crusade, but a fight for survival, as the liberal West now faces an onslaught from fascist totalitarians. So the Second World War is very much unlike the First World War in that this is not Christian nationals fighting each other. This is the liberal left, the old guard, enlightenment, and even some Christian ideas of liberty and freedom against totalitarianism. This is a war that is clearly a just war, that is clearly a war for survival. In America, meanwhile, the progressives, that is the Protestant liberals, saw in the Great War the instrument through which their utopian post-millennial ideal might be realized. Woodrow Wilson, the world might be made safe for democracy, which, by the way, is not all that ironically different from imposing American exceptionalism on nations. It's the same kind of mindset. We know better than anybody else. The left does it and the right does it. And this Wilsonian ideal became mortally ill in 1919 and then finally died in September 1939 when Germany invaded Poland. It was pretty clear that progressive ideals and utopian societies were not going to come to pass. Even Reinhold Niebuhr got it right, that sin is the human condition, and as long as sin is the human condition, utopian societies are not going to come to pass. And finally, in America, meanwhile, the fundamentalists and conservative American evangelicals saw the Great War as a call to eliminate any trace of progressive theology and German liberalism from the American church and culture. I mean, I've been involved in that fight my whole adult life. For American Christians, the Great War was the occasion to launch a culture war, a war which nearly a century later appears to have been lost as badly by the fundamentalists as the progressive vision was undone by World War II. And the emphasis, the desire to transform culture, even in the face of wars like this, is a losing cause. And look where the American church is today, its vitality, its influence, the way it's viewed by non-Christians. Compare that even a generation ago and two generations ago. We are as embarrassed by trying to transform the culture and failing as were the progressives with their utopian ideal blowing up in their face in World War II. It's the same thing. It's not the mission of the church. And we get it wrong, and we make a mess every time we try it.